This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Open conversation this morning, and we are going to bring you a beautiful one. Now, many people tend to hear on Power Zone. Sometimes, you know, when Kotane hijacks him and say, "Ah, Denzel, he definitely knows something about this. Let's talk to him. What happened when Mandela's burial was being prepared for?" Ah, Denzel there, the walking encyclopedia, just turns out, "No, Chief, you see, this is what happened when Madiba was to be buried, and they went there to the Eastern Cape." And like, this was not even a prepared for moment, just like off the cuff. You know, it was in 2010. One station described him as a person with two ostriches as pets, a deputy president as a former boss, and plenty of journalism experience. And they said, "There's certainly nothing average about Taylor." He definitely isn't average. trust me about that. He's a legend in his own right. My open conversation this morning is a sit-down with Denzel Taylor. Daddy!
Interrogation. Like,
Daddy, how are you?
I'm nervous, man.
You're on the other side of the mic.
Man, you know, yesterday when your people called me, man, yeah. I was like, is there no other person? You know, can't we find one for you? I can find one for you.
Absolutely.
And then they were like, "No, Chief, he wants
it's you.
He wants you."
It's 31 years.
How do you know these
on
things?
Your journey of journalism?
Journalism.
You joined the SABC in 1990.
How do you know these things?
No wait, Chief. It's my duty to know. I've got eyes and ears everywhere.
Yeah.
But before there was the Denzel who walked into the hallways of the SABC in 1990, there's a place where you must have grown up that has influenced you. Who are the Taylors?
So, I'll briefly explain.
Yeah.
My grandfather comes from the other side of the waters. I'm a colored person in the sense of what you would call colored.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You can debate what it is. Some people want it. Yeah. So I define myself also black. That's where I start. So my parents were involved in political activities down in the Transkei. But let's start with the grandfather. He comes over, he meets a black woman here, and he can't get married to her in South Africa proper.
Okay.
So he decides to move to the Transkei and buy land down there, and that's where the Taylors come from.
Which part of the Transkei?
Port St. John's.
Ah, PSG.
PSG. Ah. So I'm a proper PSG.
You're a second
boy.
Beach kid.
Yes. So you can see now, there's the history starting right there. You know, my grandfather falls in love with a black woman. South Africa says to him, "You can't live in broader South Africa." And he then says, "The choice is easy. I love this woman and I'm moving to the Transkei."
And something and interesting about Port St. John's, I mean, there are even shipwrecks there.
Yes, absolutely. And it's well known.
And as a result, Port St. John's was quite a very
multiracial yes, it's always been.
Town
yes.
For the longest time.
And always sort of an enclave of something that's going to happen. You know, Bantu Olomisa comes from there. Yeah, so Bantu Olomisa, there's an army base in Port St. John's. And part of that story is one morning you wake up and Bantu Olomisa has put troops on the beaches and in the town and you know, and on the borders. And you know, I got to know Bantu Olomisa quite well too because of those dynamics, you know.
Where were you when he did the coup d'etat?
Well, I was at varsity, parents still down in the Transkei, and then I took some liberated white fellows. I took them back home to politically educate them.
Okay.
So it was my contribution also part of the early part, and then I remember also I would first go around Bantu Olomisa's house. And stop there and then say, "I need to educate you properly as to who is in charge here."
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, and he would welcome us and then we'd leave from there, you know, and then we'd go back down to Port St. John's.
Of course, you would have grown up in an era where there was a lot of, you know, transition happening in the in the then Transkei as well, with the Homeland government system,
Matanzima's
era, Umtata being the capital of the then Transkei. What would you say shaped your politics, and where were your leanings in terms of political ideology?
Exactly that. You know, you in a sense you shaded from what's going on in broader South Africa. You're not impacted by it in the sense of it's impacting you directly. You are in the Transkei. You know what I'm saying? And in the Transkei, the schools are open, the swimming pools are open. There's no residential discrimination. Remember, it's a homeland, right? What happens then is it's shaped even further when Bantu Olomisa takes over. Now it's radical.
Yeah.
That also now begins to shape you further against the system, because you're living in the radical part of this broader South Africa that sees borders closed at times, sees sanctions, sees hardships, and you experience the resistance of, I'm not talking about homeland resistance, I'm talking about proper resistance to the homeland system. And when the freedom liberation movements come home, they settle there. You are then further exposed to, you know, the dynamics of this historical, you know, these historical moments, you know. So that's it. That's the shaping. And then, of course, the shaping from the parental part.
Yeah.
They were already politically in the space because of the historical of their own parents. Yeah.
Have you ever tried to trace your over the seas roots?
I've never tried, because it's not an interest, in the sense of I have an interest of the family that's here. I know some in the family might have tried. You know, but for me, it's not an important part. You know, I am a South African. I've lived by the history of this country, the influences of having grown up where I did, the influences of my parents, the influences of their parents, the influences then of this Transkei that becomes the resistance, you know, movement, or the spear. With Bantu Olomisa leading that's the experience. Yeah.
Do you ever bump into the general?
Oh yeah, he asks me now and again, when you're going home, Mfondini. Says, when you're going home, Mfondini.
Yeah,
and I do go home, you know. And but we bump into each other now, funny enough, not down there.
But in all the other spaces.
Yes,
I'm sure even now, going to the results center,
absolutely,
you might actually bump into him. Denzel, let's talk a little. I mean, do you remember the time you walked into the SABC for the first time in 1990? Mm. Who are the people that embraced you and, you know, sort of nurtured you? Because you walked in there and that was at the point of transition.
Yes, it's transition, right? So I'm beginning to look for work, right? I had two options. One was become a lawyer, because of the political space. One was become a lawyer and fight for the South Africans during this, you know, like the struggles. And the other was to become a journalist. I really, really did not see anything else
beyond those two choices.
Yes, that was it. The one ruled itself out, because I could not see myself as Dali Mpofu sees himself, in the robes and in the suits and in the briefcase and the this.
That's not you.
That was not me. You
have
know?
You ever even owned a suit?
I worked in the presidency, so I can claim to have.
We'll get to that. Yeah, so let's talk then, carry on with that moment of, so, you know, journalism then becomes the option, and then you find this job.
And there's the SABC advertising, but they advertising for new transitional aspects of the SABC. There's a new political, what is it called? The head of politics. There's a new vibe at the SABC. It's beginning to change. The new voices, the Mandelas are there, the Chris Hanis are there. You know, every aspect of this change is beginning to happen. So I thought, well, let me involve myself in this. And so I apply and I get this response that says, you know, you're appointed, but you would have to move. You'd have to move to Johannesburg. And I had no qualms about that. Cape Town had delivered me to life, and I wasn't enjoying Cape Town. I just thought it was politically, you know, backward a little bit at the time, because also the University of the Western Cape teaches you, you know, and lets you bump shoulders with the Busaks and the Tutus.
Yeah.
And
the University of the Left of Jakes Gerve.
And it was leading at that time, the early 90s and the early and the late 80s, it was leading, you know, some of the demonstrations and conflicts we were having. It was the university, and the schools in the area and around were
the Belleville
absolutely,
area.
Absolutely, yes. Belleville South, Castlefleigh, all of those schools were radical in themselves, you know. They would close for a year and think nothing of it. I mean, my first day at the University of the Western Cape, I got there and the fences were like meeting in the Great Hall.
Wow.
You know, SRC.
Yeah.
For the first
activity.
6 months. And the first 6 months of my life there, it was political activity.
Yeah.
And I jumped straight into it. You know, I mean, there was Jakes Gerve. Of course, it was the time of Jakes Gerve.
Mm.
And he was who he was. So there we were, you know, in the midst of all of that.
So, Shoops, you moved to Johannesburg.
I'm there.
Auckland Park.
Yes. And now we're beginning to change things at the SABC. So there's... What happens, the irony of that time is there's an old SABC and there's a new SABC. And the conflict in the passages, the conflict in the boardrooms, the conflict in the spaces is just, you can touch it. You know, they look at us as the new and we look. I was elected into the, I was selected and appointed into the new political team.
Okay.
The SABC had two physical political teams. It had the old, and we know who the old were, you know, and then it had this young bunch of about 12 people.
And who are some of the people you remember from that team?
There was who's the one who died, the journalist who died by her son, the lady who died, what's her name, 3 or 4 years ago, I can't remember her name.
Okay.
Now, yeah, there was Marion Edmonds. A couple of us, and it was led now by Pippa Green.
Okay.
Pippa Green was the change factor also. She had been brought in to lead this. And at some point then these two political teams get together. And then there's further conflict around that as well. And then, you know, the new political team emerges at the SABC, and I'm part of that.
And you spent a lot of your time covering CODESA.
Yes. It is the time of CODESA.
That's the time of CODESA. Mm. The negotiations are happening.
Yes, we CODESA 1, CODESA 2.
We hear a lot about how, you know, those talks were secretive. But there were journalists stationed there. You were at the World Trade Center most of your life in those years. Over those, just give us a sense. How was it, you know, covering CODESA? How open were the deliberations? How open were the politicians deliberating at the time?
I was lucky in the sense that as young as I was, I had access. Being in the space of the radicalness at the time already, I had access. I had access to, let's say, a Trevor Manuel, for example, who then becomes a minister.
Yeah.
And I've never called Trevor Manuel Minister Manuel, because there was a time when we were at UWC, when he was arrested, we would go to the prison and we would doi doi, and after his 90 days he would be turned around and he would be led back into the prisons, you know, so we would understand all of that already. We would be in Modderdam Road, you know, burning the tires, burning the bins, fighting with the security establishment who would be there, you know, taking on rubber bullets, you know. So my access was pretty easy to a lot of them, and so I found it in my space.
Yeah.
It was a little harder for other people, because these were people they didn't know, you know. So it was pretty easy for me, and the access was pretty easy. But I also, you don't, as you live it, you are so engaged in it that you don't give too much thought to 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line. You are reporting as and if when it happens. And we did that. And it's only later on in life that I realized that in as much as we reported about all the goings on then, and in as much as it was available to us and we could see it, there was a 50% that wasn't, You know, the conversations that Cyril Ramaphosa was having with the Roelof Mayor.
One-on-ones.
The one-on-ones that F.W. de Klerk might have been having with Nelson Mandela, for example, you know, and the caucuses and the focus groups and those things. And then we'd just come to the next meeting and there'd be a deal or there'd be a breakthrough or there'd be a, you know what I'm saying?
But it's not too clear how that breakthrough was achieved.
And both sides would then take victory almost, you know. The one would not see it as a concession and the other one would not. They would both see it as a victory, you know, because you were leading towards a date. The significant thing then happens is Chris Hani is assassinated. That's the break.
And everybody...
Because then you want a date.
Now, everybody, when that assassination happens, is on the verge of, you know, this might bode very terribly for the country. Mm. What's going through your mind as a journalist? What's your sense of responsibility in a moment like that?
Look, I had become a fan. I honestly, even today, I had become a fan of Chris Hani. I had out of the group now that had emerged, you know, I looked at him and the things he was saying. And he was, you know, in as much as people believe today he was a hardliner, and of course he was a hardliner, but he was beginning to take on a reconciliatory approach. Before his death, he was beginning to talk to Afrikaners. He was in the Free State. He was talking to Constant Viljoen. He was talking to white South Africans and saying, come on board. You know, this is the route we have to go. So he was one of those people. Not forgetting, though, that there were elements of which he would not negotiate. Mm. There were those principled positions that he had already taken that you could not negotiate. But he was not naive to the extreme to suggest that, you know, white South Africa had to come on board to make this thing happen. And of course, then... They assassinate him.
Are there any rumors that carried around the time of his assassination that you, as people in the media establishment at the time, were interested to explore, but maybe the space did not allow, insofar as, I mean, I'm sure you'd have been curious as to how the assassination came about. Are there any things that you think back then were not explored and perhaps we still have to explore them? When we hear the SACP talk of the need for an inquest, for example, still into the assassination of Chris.
Even the SACP, if you ask them and they're honest, will tell you that at the time we all believed what it was, you know, that two white people had you know, planned it, you know, constructed how it should happen and when it should happen, and it was just a shock to the system, and everybody was not thinking beyond. You could not even at that point fathom that it could be the conspiracy theory that is today led. You know, it only emerged much later on. You know, that people started suggesting that, and you know, could it? You know, was he such a threat, you know, to the system? And of course he was, because the man was front and forward, you know, of everything. If there were negotiations to be had, he, you know, you couldn't ignore Chris Hani. If there were elections to be had further down the line, because Chris Hani also stood back at that point. He did not at that point say he acknowledged the more experienced in the party.
Even from the 1991 at the Durban conference when he contests Thabo Mbeki and then the leaders, the elders of the ANC intervene and Walter Sisulu becomes the deputy president eventually.
Yes.
He doesn't sort of walk away from the party though.
No, he doesn't. And also, I think he knew his time was coming. He was one of those who everybody knew his time would come, you know. So that was the Chris Hani. And hence now the conspiracy theories. Yeah. If he was alive, he would be president.
He would have
today.
Done this or
if
that.
If he was alive, he would have achieved this. If he was alive, he would not have allowed this, you know. That's it.
Well, people of power, this is an open conversation with the one and only Daddy Denzel Taylor is my guest this morning, talking all things about his span of time. 31 years this year, actually, since he walked into a newsroom.
And now sitting at power.
Now sitting at Powerhouse. Mm-hmm. Denzel, it's not always easy covering politics, there's a fun, funny, interesting story you tell me sometimes about an encounter you had covering Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi, and the first time you realized that between he and Mondli Makanya, which everybody knows, if Mondli Makanya writes a piece, the prince is going to respond.
Immediately.
Okay, he's also said some not so nice things about me, but let's leave that. The first time, though, was at a rally.
Down in Ulundi. Well, the thing is if the IFP had a rally, it was down in Ulundi.
Yeah.
And it would be addressed by, the chief himself.
This day he was giving a long address.
Well, every other day. There was not one to single out. We would book into the hotel for four or five days because
just for one speech,
And on this particular day, we had gathered there. It was the likes of Justice Malala, Mondli, myself, and that was the group at the time.
Yeah.
And we then arrived there, it was the last day, and we were summoned to the front. We'd normally sit at the back, report, and to that day we were summoned to the front to be seen by the rest of, whoever the attendees were. And the prince then addresses the crowd and he says, "I have moved the journalists here to the front so that you can see them and see who they are and what they write." And then he singles out Mondli and he says, "Wena Mondli, you are a Zulu in denial." And I was like, "What does that even mean?"
Yeah.
What does that even mean? And every time when I see Mondli, I'm like, "Hey, Wena, you're a Zulu in denial."
But you probably go back to that moment and think, that was the start of a breakdown of a relationship between the two.
No. I thought at that point it was, but obviously it had been before.
Did you feel that there was some intimidation that was being done?
To all of us, as journalists,
"I'm watching you."
Yeah, all of us. I mean, I've been in that situation in a foreign country. In Zimbabwe, for example, with ZANU-PF, at their headquarters, we were all there for, elections and stuff like that, and would summon us to the front. And then there used to be, in those days, a Comrade Jesus. He would, with his spear on the table,
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. There was a Comrade Jesus in ZANU-PF. And it was, I've been through some of the most horrific and war zones.
We'll talk a little about the continent and, of course, what you think about the newsroom. What does it take to create a robust, vigilant, and truly, truly off service to the country newsroom? 0861-987-000 is the dial this morning. Thomas White, I promise there's no Comrade Jesus. Just give us power news headlines.
Only Zulus in denial.
Open conversation.
26 minutes to 12 o'clock. Let's get straight back into it with Denzel Taylor. When they say veteran journalist, I think that descriptor holds.
Not I'm old.
Not that you are old, Chief. You are just a veteran. But at least even your hair now is starting to tell the story. Or you've always grayed at a younger age.
It's been happening gradually. It's a family thing.
We were looking for Hope Zinde.
We were looking for Hope Zinde.
People of power have...
And the contribution she made at the SABC, immense. Immense.
Of course, then, it wasn't all so rosy. 17 years later, you leave the SABC. Now you do know that I've got the quote.
Yes.
When you left the
SABC.
I see
you've done homework. Eh?
Of course, I must do my homework for veterans like you. 2007, you leave. And part of what you say is that we have lost our competitive urge. That's how you close off after having said you believe in breaking news. If you get it second, you have lost. Journalism is an extremely competitive environment. We have lost our competitive edge. How do you define this competitive edge in a way that doesn't become too toxic for journalism?
Well, you've got to put it back in the time we were in. And where I was at the time, I was head of the political team. And there was more changes happening at the SABC in the sense of I started watching the political influence begin to infiltrate a little bit more. Sitting as the political head, I began to feel a little more pressure. understanding where I'd grown up, it's almost as an insult, the fact that you have the narrative of what needs to happen. You have the narrative of the situation. And then it's almost as then, Werner, you don't understand it. We are the political party. This is how. But it doesn't come to you like that. It comes to you via all sorts of other forces. You know, it's a time of Snooki Zikalala.
Mm.
You know,
where was the pressure coming from?
From the political party. From the political party. You know, the SABC has never been, in my understanding, free of that. It will always be, and it will always. It's just a matter of how deep you get into it. You know what I'm saying? But at that point, it begins to become instructive. And I was not appreciating that. The further thing that I, at that time, begin to realize at the SABC is that there's a lot of other things happening where people are merely appointed because of who they are, but not what they
bring to the table.
Yes, and what they understood about this thing called journalism. And it's beginning to not infuriate me, but it's stress me. And I'm beginning to think about what's next and where do I go next and what do I do next? And then the Yeffer Commission happens. The Yeffer Commission is a turning point. And it's sitting in Bloemfontein. And Bululani Nguga.
And let's just remind people of that commission being about Nguga having been alleged
accused,
to be a spy
number
during R the apartheid days.
159 or 156 or whatever. And it's sitting in Bloemfontein. And I get a call from Bululani Nguga himself. And he says to me, you know what, Chief? I appreciate what you are doing, your reporting. It's fair. It's balanced. It's you have neither decided whether I am a spy or you not. And I say to him, Chief, it's balanced until the point where the judge says you are. At that point, I am going to say you are. And he says, no, I appreciate that.
Mm.
That's what I appreciate about your journalism. He says, in all fairness, do that. But he says, I'm going through such a hard time with my family, my children, my grandparents. Everything is impacting this thing. But I appreciate you for what you are doing.
Mm.
But I tell him, listen, it will change if whatever. I'm sitting at the back of the room. And the person who is his partner is Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka.
Just recently made deputy president.
No, she's not.
She's not at the time.
No. She's not. She's an ordinary minister in the cabinet. And it happens that you know, Bululani is not the spy that everybody said he would have been. Okay. About 6 months later, 8 months later, I get a phone call that says, hey, Chief, the presidency wants to talk to you. The deputy president wants to talk to you. She's now deputy president. And I'm like, okay, so this is. And then the conversation is like, I need someone like you with the ethics, the integrity of yourself in my office.
That's now the turning point, you moving to the presidency.
Yes.
But let's just talk partly about this pressure that came at that time, not only just the Heffer Commission. Saki Macozoma's house is barked,
yes.
Or at least there are reports that his house is barked.
Mm.
The relationship between Billy Masetla and the president sort of breaks down.
Mm.
And at the time, Billy is heading the National Intelligence.
Mm. So it's at a crucial time.
It's at a crucial moment.
Mm. It's at a crucial
How
moment.
How much pressure is in the newsroom at that time?
On myself and me defending my team, I can tell you that I did not take that pressure and move it to the team.
Yeah.
I kept them who they were. That's the one thing I still pride myself in, is that I was able at that point when there was so much pressure to actually protect what I could protect within the SABC. But there's this big movement. Snooki is who Snooki is. Snooki Zikalala
is head of news.
But he is comrade.
But he's
on the
also,
other side.
And I mean, it's clear today, he's the president of the Veterans League in the movement.
Yes, he's a comrade on the other
what
side.
Kind
he
of
comes out of exile.
What kind of conversation did you have with him prior to your departure from the SABC?
It was a cordial relationship. in the sense of I understood where he came out of the struggle. He had respect for where I came out of the struggle, both people who understood what's going on in the political space. So there's that kind of mutual respect for both, you know, from both sides. The other thing is I am caught between what I do editorially in my professional space. I cannot let that bait and drop. I cannot just ignore it for the benefit of, you know, everything else. There are people who answer to me. There are responsibilities that I need to have. And I sit there and the pressure is, it's at its highest, I think. And I sit there and then comes the phone call, which then begins to, you know, I begin to engage. But like I say, even the political team that answered to me then, still, when they speak to me today, they say, thank you for that. Thank you for that moment, you know. So I walk into the office one day and I close my door. And I'm sitting there and I'm sitting and the secretary, she's worried about me because, you know, this is not my normal self. And, you know, I'm sitting there. And after about an hour, I open up the laptop and I'm like, dear Snukisi Kalala, I hereby hand in my resignation, you know.
This is June 2007.
Yes, he never spoke to me after that.
Till today?
I haven't seen him after that. For the month of my resignation, he never spoke to me after that.
Let me take Lorato and put him out of his way, Daddy, so that we continue. 0861-987-000 is the dial. I'm in conversation with Denzel Taylor. Lorato, good morning.
Lukona, good morning, and thank you so much for bringing us, Denzel, from a different, from a completely different perspective. Denzel, good morning.
Good morning, Chief.
So I had the honor, Denzel, this week on Black Wednesday on the 19th to participate in a panel discussion on the memorial lecture of commemorating Percy Khoboza, right? And the topic there was around the role of the media and how, you know, digital media has changed things, but also how it ought to be making sure that those who are in the margins are at least, you know, having access to content on a consistent basis. And my input and contention was that, unfortunately, a lot of those come out of necessity. And I use the Daily Vox as an example, because you'll remember during the Fees Must Fall era or time, the students felt that the picture that was being shown about them and the story that was being told about them was not a complete story. And that's how the Daily Vox emerged, right? And of course, then there's another amazing online publication called The Ground Up, and I imagine you may know of it, right? But my concern, or at least what I raised there, was the sustainability of such platforms. And I know that I'm not, I'm awake to the fact that you are employed by Power FM, and I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, tell us or share with us how other media houses ought to, come up with better business models. But the question really is, how do we ensure that the Daily Voxes of this world, the Ground Ups of this world, create models that are sustainable, financial models and business models that are sustainable, because they have such a huge, huge, role in creating a lot more inclusive access to important information and news coverage that deals with issues, unlike a lot of these that are more. And I'm not necessarily saying that Power is not doing it with or all the other traditional stations, right, or media platforms. How do we create that kind of, democratizing information, content, and news to cover those who are in the market?
Okay, Lorado, got you loud and clear. Thank you very much. On 0861-987-000. Daddy?
So, of course, you have what we call the traditional media, newspapers and radio and TV, right? And it's a hard time for media houses at the moment, I believe. You know, COVID didn't help also. And then people see the gap of where you begin to infiltrate, where there are weaknesses. But let me answer the question this way.
Yeah.
If you asked me, whether I am happy with where the state of journalism is, and I'm talking to journalism now, is in this country, not broad media.
Yes,
journalism is in this country. I'm a little disappointed. I'm disappointed in the sense of people have not bothered to absolutely garner the skill, to garner the experience. Firstly, embody that. That then makes you understand product and what the listener wants.
Mm.
I feel today that if I listen to a bulletin or I'm listening to TV, that we are there about ourselves. It is how Denzel Taylor sounds. It's what Denzel Taylor has put into the soundbite, whether he's cut a beautiful little controversial little clip or something like that. It's about ourselves. So when I'm sitting in the car or driving around, I struggle to find out what the value and the sense of that is to me in the car at that point. And then I start putting somebody else in that seat and I think, actually, that meant nothing. So I evaluate it harshly now in that space. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of it, we don't do enough for the listener. And there's my experience. So in that sense, gaps begin to open. If your product drops and product all over drops in the sense of journalism, other people will enter that space. Other people who might understand it and say, ah, the SABC has dropped its editorial, the SABC, let's do this. And that's where I'm hoping that people who might understand the game, who might understand this thing called journalism, the thing called editorial, because within this journalism thing, there's a word called editorial. That's
and,
the key
and
word.
There's a second word, decisions.
Yes, but on based on editorial, what is the story? What is the value? What does the listener want to take out of this? I can go to a press conference of an hour. There's no editorial decision in me bringing you the hour.
Yeah.
I've done nothing. I've just brought you the hour. I've plugged in on the one side and plugged you. The editorial skill that I'm that for me lacks today.
In fact, on that point,
it's the decision.
In fact, on that point, Bazima Shilowa says on Twitter, the thing with Denzel Taylor is not that he was apolitical. Very few people are. It is that he is ethical and has integrity. What is happening now, where channels fall over themselves to carry rallies conveniently planned to take over prime space, would not fly.
There you go. Yeah, that's basically, that's what I'm saying, is that we hustle these days. People are saying, I hustled myself into power. I hustled myself into the SABC. I'm hustling. And then they go and get second and third and other little hustle spaces on the side. And they have not bothered to embody. So here's the dilemma for me.
Mm.
If you have not embodied the skill, if you have not taken it in, if you have not embodied the editorial and the experience, now there are youngsters sitting in front of you. What are you going to do?
Who must teach this skill?
We do. The responsibility is ours. But the problem is that the people, and I'm going to say it as controversial as it might be, some of the people sitting in these positions have themselves not taken in the experience, taken in the skill, taken in the editorial. And so when that decision is made to somebody else, and the product is returned, they see it as fine, even when it is really, really lacking. So they see it as fine. It's the glass is half full or the glass is
empty. At some point, you were involved with journalism at the University of Pretoria,
yes.
Teaching there.
Yes, and I nurtured quite a few products that I can say, you know, came through my hands there.
Including in the newsroom.
Let's
pay some bills. I want to talk a bit about why you believe archiving is such important work. You've been doing some beautiful documentaries here on Power 98.7. We'll chat a bit about that. I see Tabo on 0861-987-000. If anybody wants to have a quick comment to Denzel Taylor, please do dial in quickly because I do want to hug him to myself. It's amazing. I see him almost every day in the building, but some of the things that he's sharing today and so passionately, you know, I clearly need to dig in some more in this gent.
Speak up. Call the power line on 0861-987-000.
Indeed, it is 8 minutes to 12. Let's just probably wrap up this segment on the media so that we move to your time at the presidency and how you land back here, you know, at Power 98.7. When did you start knowing that, you know, archiving must form part of the things that you care about, especially in the media space where so much is happening and so much can get lost?
I've always felt that, you know, we need to be able to do that. You know, and my sadness is based on what I've just said, is that we have now come the soundbite people. We now basically put a story out there and we're chasing the next soundbite, and there's no context and there's no content. So we don't bring that to the table a lot. So I've always felt passionately about that. And the nice thing about Power 98.7 is that being somebody who is Denzel Taylor, we then begin to say, okay, what do we do about this platform that wants to talk differently to people? Differently. I mean, yes, of course, you know, we can all engage the soundbite and we can all engage the fluff, but how does Power 98.7 engage differently? And it's not just something that happens here at Power. It's in the DNA that you have to be able to do that. So a documentary type piece of content fits perfectly on the platform, is that people engage it because it comes with the historical. And people say, oh, I didn't understand that. I now get this. I didn't know that, you know? And then people engage differently. It's just how the power, you know, the power people are. Yeah. If once you engage the soundbite here, people will, you know, come at you and say,
Let me take you back now to another moment in history. So you get the call from then Deputy President Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka looking for a guy like you. You guys eventually get it on. You agree. You move there. You are comms manager as Gisa. And then eventually you become spokesperson to the DP. September 2008 happens. Polokwane happens. September 2008 happens. President resigns for the first time.
Yes.
In South Africa. How was that moment in the presidency?
Remember now, I'm sitting in the Mbeki administration. Here's the thing about, and I have this conflict as well with spokespeople today and people who work in government today. I'm not talking about in the ministerial, in the political party, deployees. I'm not talking about deployees. I'm talking about people who obviously work in comms and stuff like that. You will not go back to my life in the presidency where you will find that I spoke, even though I might come with the background that I have, where I spoke of the ANC, to the ANC and about the ANC.
Now we see them wearing T-shirts and rallies.
2 o'clock in the afternoon, somebody
they are doing party work.
Yes, you know, wearing the party shirt, and I believe people know my historical. I don't have to put it in front of you and brush you up every day with it. You know what I'm saying? So I am that person, and I behave as the spokesperson does, and then this does happen, and it rattles everybody.
Absolutely.
Because remember, I'm in the deputy presidency, and the questions start happening now. What's going to happen here? You know, because obviously it's going here. And the questions in the presidency is, will he go, won't he go, what's going to go on? But being so close to it, you begin to get some insight as to where this is going. You know, the conversations are what. The big question that then happens is, what does the deputy president do in my space?
Yeah.
All the conversations, and I'll fast forward, and then Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka invites us. National Intelligence, if you're listening, all those forms I signed. Well, I'm going to tell this little
well,
story.
Well, tell this little story.
Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka invites us to the house in Cape Town, her residence there. And she invites five people. And she says, I invited the five closest to me, who guide me every day, who tell me every day what I must do. And she says, what must I do? Tell me, people, and I will do it. And we go, this one says, no, you must stay. This one says, no, I think you must go. This one says, no, you must stay. This one says, no, you must go. And she says, thank you very, very much. And it's over tea. It's casual, you know. It's over tea. And she says, thank you very much, everybody. So I have a question for all of you. She says, what would TM, she said exactly like, what would TM say if I stayed? Then we said, well, Deputy President, you have to go. you know, if the,
irrespective of what that would mean for you guys your prospects.
Her question was, what would TM say
if I stayed?
If I stayed. So she based it around that. On principle. Not on whether, you know, I should finish the work and whether, and whether, you know, it's good for me and it's good for you. What would he say? How would he feel about my decision to stay? And we said, then you have to go. And she said, precisely, go and type my resignation letter. And I walked into the next room and I typed four copies, four versions of it. And she would change it. And I typed another version and she would change it. And then she said, thank you very much. Signed. Now, go deliver these.
So you were at the heart of that resignation. Did she ever cry?
No. She might have cried in public, in private, but she never did. The one time I did see her crying was Mhlabandlovu, just after the president had been asked to resign, and he had said to them, yes, he's leaving, before he announced. And we were there. And she hugged, Toko Didiza. They were very close, and I believe they're still close today. Toko Didiza came over to the house, and they just sat and sobbed in each other's arms. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, this is a moment.
And
know?
This is happening.
This is happening.
Let's
But in front of her staff, she was that person. She was the deputy president of the country.
Let's take Tabo. Tabo, good morning.
Morning, Lukman. You know, they deserve to be in the book. You have to write a book. Mm. Denzel.
Yes, Chief.
4 May 1990. As a young journalist, then you have to cover the biggest story in the history of South Africa. Mm. Is there a moment where you picked up something? Because of, we all know that a lot of things were swept under the carpet. There was a lot of secrecy there. Is there a moment where maybe you picked up something that didn't make sense to you then, but it made sense to you later, as to say, oh, you know, as much as things were not negotiated in the best interest of Black South Africa.
Okay. Mm. So, got you loud and clear.
I'm also watching his clock.
Yeah.
So I'll answer it
quickly.
Very shortly. Of course you're aware, but if you're in the political space that you are at that time, you want it to happen. You want to get to the election date. You want to get to, you know, where the ANC or whoever would then take over. So yes, of course, you are aware of some things, but, you know, at that point, they're not that massive in the sense of the bigger picture is we are getting to an election and we are getting to a different South Africa, you know, at some point. So these small little things that are happening, my understanding now is that those small little things that might have happened and been swept under the carpet at that point are now the big issues that might hold South Africa back today.
We might, Dadi, have to come back to those questions. You're landing here at Power and what you probably envisage.
Let me tell you this. It's got everything to do with the chairman giving him curry.
What did he whisper in your ear?
No, he walked into a different newsroom where I was and he said, who's the guy who changed this newsroom? And I said, Ndimlo, it's me. And he said, I need you at Power, young man.
Chief, you were poached at work.
Yeah.
And from there onwards, you came to Power.
I came to
Power. And you headed news, of course.
Yes, they made different offers to keep me back there. And then Mkari asked me one day, he said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm coming.
And you came.
And I came.
And you're still here.
And I'm still here.
One day we'll have a chat about what is it that you're doing? What is it that you think you need to do with your time? I'm not saying you're close to retirement, but when the time comes.
Oh, Chief, I'm young.
Young at heart. Thomas White, if Denzel Taylor is young, I don't know what that makes you.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.